From Michigan Radio, I'm Cynthia Canty, and this is a State of Opportunity special, When Neighbors Say More Than Hello.
I not only have my family, but I have extended family, and we all look out for each other.
It's a very nice thing to know that you're all a part of something, no matter how different you may be, no matter what walks of life you may come from, you know what I mean, how much money you got in the bank.
If somebody no longer can drive, they can't make it to doctor's appointments or even to get groceries. So even beyond just nursing, there's all kinds of things that we do to help people stay in their homes.
This was the community coming together to help build this community center and also to take ownership of it.
When Neighbors Say More Than Hello, a State of Opportunity special. But first, the news. Welcome to this State of Opportunity special, When Neighbors Say More Than Hello. I'm Cynthia Canty. What's the most important thing to consider when you're choosing a neighborhood? Your real estate agent would probably tell you location, location, location. But what makes one neighborhood different from another just a few blocks over? One key factor, the relationships among the people living there. In other words, neighbors, neighbors, neighbors. Just how well do you know your neighbors?
I know most of my neighbors. I live in an apartment building. It's only 12 apartments in my building. I'm the most popular guy there because I know everybody actually in the building.
I would like to know my neighbors better. More of a community event where people can gather, mix up. That would be a good option. It kind of builds in a community trust that you know your neighborhood, you know where the people are coming from. And once you have a community trust, it kind of links away with your quality of life. So I would be less worried if I knew my neighborhood.
We know our neighbors really well in my area. For the most part, all of us have lived there for at least 25 to 30 years. The same group of neighbors always celebrates holidays together, which is awesome.
I'm sort of the exact opposite. I'll associate with my neighbors and stuff and have a fun time, but I try not to put too much burden on them. And I've had some bad neighbors in the past, so I just sort of let them do their own thing. And I'm friendly and I'm sociable, but I don't try to get into their business and I let them stay out of my business, and it's nice.
Today, you'll meet neighbors from three different Michigan communities, people working together to solve local problems. They're not waiting around for someone else to fix it. They're digging in, and they're doing it for themselves. Not only do these grassroots efforts yield creative solutions, it turns out that really getting to know the people who live around you can have a profound impact on your life. And there's research to back this up. Jeffrey Morinoff is director of the Population Studies Center at the University of Michigan. Jeffrey, what do we really know about how neighborhoods shape our lives?
Well, I would say there's at least four critical dimensions on which neighborhoods shape our lives. One of them you've already alluded to, which is who you live near and how you interact with those people. So that's something that sociologists in particular are very interested in because it pertains to the kinds of interactions you have with your neighbors. But there are also other dimensions. Another dimension, for example, is the kinds of stress that you might be exposed to from different kinds of events or the presence of different kinds of industries or actors. And that ties into a third, which is the physical environment itself. And that could come from pollution in the air, as we've seen more recently, water pollution, and even exposure to noise can have a big impact. And then the final one would be the kinds of institutions and organizations that are in your neighborhood. Another intuitive point, but they make a big difference.
So all of that can really have an impact on physical and mental health.
Absolutely. So there's been studies looking both at the mental and the physical side, and on the physical side, trying to drill down and look at specifically what kinds of health outcomes and also look for evidence that it really is having a physical effect on your health, not just an effect on the people who are reporting the status of their health.
And Jeffrey, here we live in a country where, you know, your zip code is shaped very largely in part by your income, and low-income people, especially those who are minorities, are much more likely to live in a neighborhood with concentrated poverty. So how hard is it to disentangle the effects of poverty and the influence of neighborhoods?
There's a classic article called Poor People and Poor Places, and it's very important to conceptually distinguish between what we mean here. The individual experience of living in poverty can be very profound, but there is also evidence to suggest that if you take people of varying socioeconomic levels and compare the ones that are living in more impoverished neighborhoods to the ones who are living in better off neighborhoods, that the environment around them still makes a big difference. And that goes back to those four main mm-hmm. reasons that I described before.
So let's look at then this relationship, because if, you know, as you say, you may not be able to control the fact that there is, as we've seen in Flint, water that is tainted, or folks in the southwest Wayne County, Detroit area when the Petcoke was blowing through. So you've got these environmental factors. So the thing you can control, in a sense, is relationship amongst each other. Does that actually provide an insulation, in a sense, from some of these external effects that you may not be able to control as well?
Yes. I should say that there's not conclusive and definitive evidence on this, and this research is still in its infancy. However, there is evidence to suggest that those kinds of social support structures can buffer people, especially when they are experiencing very stressful times or very stressful environments. One area where you see the most research on this probably is exposure to violent crime in areas around where people live. And having a support structure is one of the factors that does help to mitigate those kind of harmful effects on, especially on the lives of children and their development, their cognitive skills, their academic achievement.
And when you say support structure, what might that look like, from house to house, along street to street?
Well, it begins inside the family. And I think for different ages, different elements are more important. When you're an infant or a toddler, it's your parents that are the most important. When you move up to elementary school age, the school system itself becomes more of a factor. And then when you reach adolescence, it's the peers, your similar age kids around you, and wider influences of the neighborhood. And then when you go into adulthood, institutions become much more important in your day-to-day life, the kinds of services they provide, the businesses around you, but also the provision of health care and law enforcement is also a huge issue.
Is this what we talk about when we say social cohesion? What do we mean by that?
Yeah, social cohesion means different things to different people. But in the way that I've studied it and many other social scientists have studied it, it's the degree to which people trust and interact with one another and share, or at least think they share, common values with the people who live around them.
And I am guessing that does not necessarily have anything to do with income level or socioeconomic status, that you could have social cohesion in a neighborhood that is a low-income or stressed neighborhood and never see it in a high-income neighborhood.
Absolutely. And this is why this mechanism is so fascinating to sociologists, for exactly the reason you said, because it does not get strongly patterned by the amount of income you make or the amount of wealth that you have. It depends on other factors. Some of them are geographic factors about the neighborhood itself. Mm-hmm. Some of them are more social, like how long have people lived in that neighborhood and whether there is a preponderance of kids in the neighborhood, which are one of the ways that people get to meet each other.
So when we think about where we are largely as a country, so many of us, where we barely know the neighbors around us, you might know who's next door, one side or the other, and that's it. How did we get to that point where knowing a lot of neighbors around us is the exception rather than the rule?
That's a very complicated question, and I think goes back to a long history of urban growth and decline, and now maybe revitalization, moving out to the suburbs to more expansive tracts of land, becoming more geographically isolated from our neighbors. But I think that now, and not just now, but maybe for the last decade or so, people are starting to reappreciate the value of knowing your neighbors. And developers are constructing housing communities that reflect that and that have people living in higher density communities and where they can stimulate more interactions between neighbors.
When I think of the kind of houses we saw built in the suburbs through the 90s and the 2000s, no front porch. And everything is on the back, the deck, the patio. It does not – nobody's sitting out front the way that I remember us doing growing up in the city of Ferndale in the 50s and 60s.
Another historical reflection of that is changes in the way that police do their job. Way back at the beginning of American policing, the cops would walk the beat. But then beginning in around the 1940s, where reform efforts came underway in part to combat corruption – there was an emphasis on police not living in the same neighborhood and riding around in patrol cars and not getting out and talking to neighbors. They thought that the more distance they had, the more objective they could be and the more fair they could be. But then that has reversed itself in more recent years, and there's been a return to an emphasis on community policing so that, that police are, again, walking the beat, trying to find out what's happening in the neighborhood and trying to build on the cohesion that exists among neighbors and, if possible, create more of it.
Jeffrey, can you give us a sense, maybe an example from the research that would show us how social cohesion can change a neighborhood?
I can give you an example that you might find a little bit counterintuitive, but in my research on returning prisoners, I asked them this question: what is it about the place that you live that really is making a difference, do you think, in your ability to reintegrate into society? And one of the unexpected answers that I got was the degree to which a community supports recovery really matters. So the degree to which maybe they have recovering drug addicts and alcoholics who attend regular meetings and who see each other on a day-to-day basis and can know whether you're falling off the wagon or whether you're still with the program, so to speak, really makes a concrete difference in their lives.
People around you who have shared your kinds of experiences.
Exactly. People who have shared your kinds of experiences.
There are so many things we cannot control about their neighbors, about our neighborhoods. But do you think some of the research on neighborhoods could help give everyone a blueprint or a template to the kinds of things that neighbors can do that would really make a difference in improving everyone's lives?
I don't think that the science is quite at that point yet where we can offer specific prescriptive remedies for what you can do to inject your neighborhood with more social cohesion or a magic pill that's going to improve everybody's quality of life. But I think that many of the things that we've been talking about, having a more stable residential base, knowing who your neighbors are, the more little steps that you can take to create informal organization among neighbors or to participate in more formal voluntary associations and other organizations that exist in the neighborhood, that would probably, I would guess, make everybody better off in the long run.
Well, we'll get some good examples of that later in this hour. Jeffrey Morinoff directs the Population Studies Center at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Still to come, working together to keep seniors in their Leelanau County homes and filling potholes in Hamtramck.
You know, we didn't get told all our lives that you can change the world and not have it manifest itself into something like this. You know, this is the product of encouraging people to stand out and do something, bring people together.
You're listening to a State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio. Welcome back to our State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio, When Neighbors Say More Than Hello. I'm Cynthia Canty. In Leelanau County, there's a group of over 350 seniors who help each other out. The organization is called Share Care of Leelanau. The goal is to keep seniors in their own homes. Volunteers help their neighbors with day-to-day things like fall yard pickup or rides to appointments. Morgan Springer of Interlochen Public Radio went along for one of those rides.
Nancy Hunter is 77 years old, and she lives in Leland with her husband. Today, she's picking up Margaret Skiba, who lives about 10 minutes away. Margaret has an appointment in Traverse City to get her hair washed and set.
Oh, look at that. Look what I got.
I know. You knew I bought that.
As she gets into the car, Margaret spots a sweet roll on the passenger seat.
Well, God love you. Is that really for me?
It is for you.
Woo! Okay. Hubba, hubba.
Margaret is 92 years old. She's lived in Leelanau County most of her life, and her kids live nearby. She says she does not drive anymore because her kids asked her not to.
It kind of hurt me because, you know, now I have to depend on somebody to take me where I want to go.
Margaret says not being able to drive has been the hardest part about getting older, but she's not completely stuck at home. Nancy is what ShareCare calls the driver of the day.
If you're driver of the day, you leave yourself open for anything that needs to be done.
When ShareCare first set Nancy up with Margaret 2 years ago, Nancy says they hit it off right away, talking the entire ride. Now they make sure ShareCare arranges it so Nancy drives Margaret whenever she can.
You know, you do get to the point where it's more than just driving. You want to be sure they're okay and that they're not sick and they're not in the hospital. And because if they were, then you'd want to do more.
I was a little girl, and we had to walk 5.5 miles to school one way, which was 11 miles a day.
That's Margaret. Nancy says they often talk about the past on their rides.
And I'll tell you, you didn't do no frogging around. You had to really run and walk fast.
Nancy asks a lot of questions and listens closely. Today, she asks Margaret how she met her husband.
Haba, haba. He was engaged to my sister.
Oh. Margaret. Did you take him away from
her? No, she left him. And he said, boy, that was the best thing that could have ever happened.
Margaret and Nancy laugh a lot, and they're affectionate. Margaret often reaches across the middle of the car for Nancy's arm as they talk, especially when they're laughing.
Hi there. How are
you? How are you?
They arrive at Murrah's Hair Care in Traverse City. The salon is simple, no fuss. Nancy hangs out for a few minutes, takes Margaret's coat, then leaves.
Okay, so
about an hour or so.
About an hour.
A little better.
Yep. Okay.
Nancy hasn't had to ask for much help from ShareCare yet, but she knows she'll probably need it someday. Right now, she's happy being Margaret's volunteer.
You know, she hasn't lost her zest for life. You know, and I call her and say, how are you feeling today, Margaret? Better than yesterday. So, you know, she keeps a very positive attitude. I mean, that's catching.
And Margaret says she has more time left in her.
I would like to live to see 100. Yeah. But God only knows.
For State of Opportunity, I'm Morgan Springer.
ShareCare's motto is neighbors helping neighbors. Since it began in 1994, ShareCare has built a team of neighbor volunteers, independent contractors, and a registered nurse. Here with us now is Barb Coy. She's one of the founders of ShareCare of Leelanau. And Deb Weatherby. She's the ShareCare office manager. Barb, so many of us visit Leelanau, but give us an idea of what it's like to live there year-round, especially if you're a senior.
The fact that so many people visit Leelanau County is exactly why many of us are here now as retirees. And it's a beautiful area. We enjoyed our summers here with our children and all. Now our children live elsewhere, and we're here enjoying the retirement. But we're on a 40-mile-long peninsula. If you look at your hand as the lower peninsula of Michigan, we're that little finger sticking out there with water on all three sides. And the distance from the top of the peninsula down to Traverse City is 40 miles. So as we aged, we began to think what services were available in this rural community, which is mostly orchards and vineyards. And that was what got us to, well, think about our future.
And Deb, I've got to imagine there are such practical challenges in getting home nursing care to people who need it in this very rural setting.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that one of the things that is difficult, too, is transportation. That's one of the biggest issues. If somebody no longer can drive, they can't make it to doctor's appointments or even to get groceries. So even beyond just nursing, there's all kinds of things that we do to help people stay in their homes.
Give us an idea of some of the kinds of services.
Most everything we do with volunteers. Our members volunteer, and we have a handful of non-member volunteers too, but for the most part, it's volunteers, and they can get people to appointments, and it doesn't matter whether it's a hair appointment or an appointment with your oncologist. They're all important for people's health and well-being.
And what I'm gathering, before we talk about the genesis of this all, I'm gathering while these practical things are being done, whether it's the patio furniture being put away or somebody being taken to a hair or a physician's appointment, people are getting to know each other.
Exactly. And that's really important because, as we described the community, it is rural and people live down long little roads out to the edge of the water somewhere, and they don't have next door neighbors like in the old days or in the city. They don't have a neighbor or family that are necessarily nearby. So the fact that people get to know each other through an organization of this sort is one way to keep the isolation of seniors, which can be very dangerous, at its lowest level. I can't say that it's all gone, but most of the isolation we look after, because we also have our RN and our office who are monitoring people and calling and saying, how are you, and is everything okay, and so forth. So it works very well from that point of view.
Well, give us an idea how you got started and then built momentum to turn ShareCare of Leelanau County into what it is today.
It started with a funny conversation due to the fact that we have a walkie-talkie group that meets every Friday morning, a bunch of women who walk all over the place. On one particular day back in 1991, we had to climb three stories to get to this woman's living room after the walk was over in order to have our coffee. And I said to her, what are you going to do if something happens to hips or your back or something as you're aging? And that started the conversation, and three women invited our husbands to join us in the conversation. What we were wondering as new residents was, full-time residents, was what's available out there? And we found that it was pretty sparse. We studied the issue over a year of dinner meetings once a month and brought our assignments to the next month's meetings. And at the end of that year, we composed a outline of an organization and invited our friends to come and hear it. And out of that meeting, we ended up with a board of about 25 people who were willing and thought the idea was a good one and were willing to work on it.
And kick in some money, right?
Yes, there were 23 of those people, couples who contributed $1,000 each as startup money. So we did have seed money. They are the charter members of ShareCare.
As someone is listening to us talk and they hear you describe what you're doing with ShareCare of Leelanau County and thinking, boy, would we like to have that in our community. What does it take? Is it expensive? Is it more just a matter of volunteering?
Well, let me tell you that our expenses last year totaled $165,000 for the office, the overhead, fundraising, everything involved. That's what it was. And that's covering the services to and by and for some 400 people. So we think that we're doing it at a very minimal, very well-managed level. And the management of ShareCare is the members themselves. Part of why people join at a young age, say 65 and 70, where they're healthy and they're not even thinking about those tough days at the end of their lives. The reason they're joining now is because they really do want to volunteer. They really do see the value to helping others in the neighborhood reach the goal of staying in their own homes as long as possible and with as high a quality of life as possible.
Does that money come from donations, from grants? Do people pay to join?
Not grants. The dues are from initiation fees for the membership and an annual dues program.
I think, Barbara, as someone who's seen this grow from those first conversations in 1991, what do you think the most rewarding part of building ShareCare has been for you?
Well, during those early days, I worked with a number of people. This was 20 years ago now, or over 20 years ago. And sadly, a number of them are gone now. But I was able to watch their end-of-life days achieved in their home at the best possible quality. I can think of the person who served as my vice president for a couple of years, and then shortly after we got the organization going, was diagnosed with ALS. And teams of guys went in to help him shower, and teams of people helped him go to bed every evening because his wife couldn't lift him anymore, things of that sort. And they all were happy about doing it. And it was just, if a sad event like that could ever be called a pleasure, it was a pleasure to see the warmth surrounding him in his last days rather than being filled with tubes and being handled by strangers in a hospital. That was our purpose.
Deb Weatherby, how have you seen ShareCare build that sense of neighborhood in Leelanau County?
Well, I think it just builds it from its involvement with each other. And we have social events every year. We have a royal banquet where we celebrate our people who have turned 90 in the last year or 100. I think our oldest member right now is 104, I think. That's a really special day where we interview the honorees and then have a lovely dinner at a local restaurant. We also have a lot of people attend our annual meeting, and we also host educational workshops and social workshops. So they have a lot of opportunity beyond helping each other with volunteering. They have a lot of opportunity to socialize.
Helping seniors stay in their homes in Leelanau County since 1994, Share Care of Leelanau County. And we've been speaking with Barb Coy and Deb Weatherby of Share Care. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you. It was a great to be here.
It was fun to talk about it and remember back.
When a neighborhood's got a problem, sometimes all it takes is a few people coming up with solutions over drinks. About a year and a half ago, a group of Hamtramck neighbors decided they were fed up with the horrible road conditions in their town. They got together, bought some cold patch, and began filling potholes. And soon, more neighbors joined in. They called themselves the Hamtramck Guerrilla Road Crew. By the time they finished, they'd laid down 36 tons of cold patch and fixed 41 blocks worth of potholes. Two of the original members of the Hamtramck Road Crew are Jeff Salazar and Maritza Garibay. They recently sat down at the very same dive bar where they came up with the idea.
It was an idea that evolved. It started out with just a question, is anything going to happen to us, any kind of penalties going to come if we start to do this ourselves? And after getting sort of an unofficial clear from the city, John and Maritza and everybody got together, started asking if anybody wanted to join, and everything just kind of rolled off from there.
We met a ton of people that we probably wouldn't have met if this thing didn't happen. And we've maintained those relationships with them, too.
You almost forget that you met them there. They're just kind of like a part of your life. You know what I mean? It's just you walk down the street, you say, hey, what's going on? Whoever happens to recognize you from either working on it or seeing you in the news, they know that it was a generally positive thing, and they love it.
The recognition was strange for me, because I didn't expect to be recognized for, you know, filling holes in the street. But I'm a teacher. I started work at a new school this year. And when I started, some of the kids were staring at me like, are you the girl that was in that picture I saw on Facebook? Like, or like, you know, going to the supermarket the summer that we were working on this, you know, our face was plastered all over the place, and people at the supermarket, oh, you're the pothole girl, you're a pothole girl.
I think they saw that if you have a loud enough voice with enough people that, you know, whoever you're trying to yell at is going to hear you. In this case, the city government heard our cries to get things done. And if you look at the roads now, I mean, we have large streets that have been completely ripped up and repaved in a very nice way.
You know, we didn't have to do any work this year. It was done. So, and they're still working on them. The street, you know, one street south of my block is currently being ripped up and totally repaved.
Cliche as it sounds, maybe it's been made to sound that way, that we actually do have a voice. We do have some weight to our pleas to have things change for the better in the city. And it showed people that it can be done. It showed all the naysayers that say, oh, that'll never happen. Well, now it has. So the game's been kind of reset, at least around here.
Everyone looks out for each other. People are really involved. You know, they care about, you know, the woman that lives behind me yells at me if I don't take my trash can in, you know, the day of trash day, you know. So you get the experience and of living in a city, but, you know, you still have those old-time, you know, small-town guys that hang out, and it's really nice. I love it here.
It's been very inspirational. It actually inspired me to run for school board here in Hamtramck, and, you know, I want to bring that same dedication, that same motivation to the schools that we brought to the streets. everybody meeting each other who did solidified a lot of friendships. You know, even when I'm knocking on doors, every now and again I'll come across someone who goes, hey, yeah, we patched the roads last year together, you know. And it's a very nice thing to know that you're all a part of something, no matter how different you may be, no matter what walks of life you may come from, you know what I mean, how much money you got in the bank. Everyone participated in the same thing, and that kind of leveled the playing field for how much you can contribute, you know.
My favorite was someone called us libertarian anarchists, and that was the I thought that was hilarious. Yeah, it was so
people
it's
are always
so
gonna,
funny.
People are always going to try to like throw a title on something, you know what I mean? Help them wrap their minds around it a little better, because it's so hard, I think, to think about. You know, people aren't politically motivated; they're communitively motivated, socially motivated. We want to see these changes, so we're going to make them happen. You know, we didn't get told all our lives that you can change the world and not have it manifest itself into something like this. You know, this is the product of encouraging people to stand out and do something, bring people together. This is what it brings.
Coming up next, how the neighbors of Fabulous Acres in Lansing realized it really does take a village.
And I had always been saying that, you know, someone needs to do something to help these kids out on the street. Someone needs to do something. Finally, something kicked in my head, and I said, I need to do something.
You're listening to our State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio. You're listening to a State of Opportunity special when neighbors say more than hello. When you decide where you're going to live, you're getting more than the home, the condo, or the apartment. You're getting a neighborhood and the people in it. On the corner of South Washington and Garden Street in Lansing, you'll find a brown sign with the words, Welcome to Fabulous Acres Neighborhood, painted in bright yellow letters. The community is just south of where the Diamond Rio plant once turned out its cars and trucks. By January 1980, that plant had been torn down. But Fabulous Acres lives on. That's largely thanks to the efforts of residents. They've worked hard to build a safe and vibrant neighborhood. Within just a few blocks, you'll find three urban gardens, a park with a playground and picnic tables, and Village Summit, a foreclosed home that's been turned into a micro-community center. State of Opportunity producer April Van Buren took a trip to Lansing to see just what these neighbors have built.
If you want to get to know Fabulous Acres, you have to start at Miss Dottie's house.
Hi, Dottie.
How are you?
Yes. Hi, nice to meet you.
Dottie Armstrong has lived in the neighborhood for 36 years. And even on this cold, drizzly day, she seems excited to show it off.
Okay, where do you want to start it?
We walk a few houses down and arrive at our first stop on the unofficial Fabulous Acres tour.
This garden right here is called 123 Angel Garden.
She points out an angel figure in the crook of one of the trees.
And the angel is for all the neighbors. Every time I plant a plant, I plant it in memory and, you know, pray over it and stuff like that of the people in the neighborhood who've passed.
Armstrong walks me through the remnants of this summer's crops. There are still a few jalapeno peppers holding on in late October. She hands me a couple and then reaches down and pulls out a large, lumpy mass covered in dirt.
This is my first year doing potatoes. I'm amazed. Never thought I could get a potato to grow. These are my potatoes.
Wow, they're big.
I'm going to take that one home and eat it today.
Armstrong takes a lot of pride in this garden, but she's quick to tell me it isn't something she could do on her own. All summer long, people from the neighborhood come by to help plant and pull weeds.
And the kids will come down here, little kids who've never planted anything in their life. Oh, Miss Dottie, you're in the garden? Let's go in the garden. So a lot of this work I contribute to those little kids.
Everyone pitches in a little work and then gets a share of whatever grows. That seems to be how a lot of things work here in Fabulous Acres. Take, for example, the park that sits across from Armstrong's house. It used to be an old factory parking lot, littered with broken glass.
So everybody got together, kept going, city council, kept going, hey, we got this patch of land, Diamond Reel's not there anymore, why can't we have it?
Today, it's a park with colorful playground equipment, a couple of picnic tables, and a grill that gets fired up at every neighborhood block party. On summer evenings, Armstrong says you'll often find her right here, surrounded by just about everybody's kids.
When I sit in the park, people let their kids out like, well, Miss Dottie's in the park, so everybody, kids, you can go outside now. when I leave the park, all the kids go home. I said, I didn't sign up for this, but they know I'm a sucker for the kids, so.
Like Armstrong, a lot of the families in the neighborhood have lived here for decades. As we walk down the street, Armstrong points to each house we pass.
Sarah lives there. She's been here forever. Bessie Lightfoot, my sister from another mother, lives there.
It was that same sense of community that first attracted Marcus Brown to Fabulous Acres over 20 years ago.
This was a beautiful neighborhood, and it was a community in the sense that people knew that they could borrow from each other or they can go to each other for a lot of different things.
As a teacher in the public schools, Brown wanted to live in the same neighborhood as his students. He says kids knew they could always stop by his house to borrow a book or a chessboard or get some help on their homework. In 2008, he decided to take that a step further. Brown cashed in some of his retirement savings and bought the foreclosed house next door. Then he started making renovations to convert it into a community center. Pretty soon, the whole neighborhood was pitching in.
And people started coming in. Oh, I'm going to help paint this room right here. I'm going to redo these floors right here. I'm going to help build this handicap ramp. I'm going to help do the landscaping here. So it became something that people took possession of.
On the front of the house, a wooden sign with brightly colored letters spells out Village Summit. Brown named it after the old proverb about raising a child. And the center lives up to the name. Neighbors volunteer to organize winter coat drives, Halloween parties, and Easter egg hunts. Kids drop in to use the computer and borrow books from the center's library. At 4 o'clock, Dottie Armstrong walks to the corner to greet kids for the first day of afternoon tutoring. While we're waiting for the bus, she tells me about a recent call she got from her son. He lives in Nashville. He was trying to convince her to move. She politely declined.
I said, I'm going to be like Red Man. I'm going to stay in the hood. This is my home. I said, I lived here. I basically grew up here, and you'll probably carry me out of here. I wouldn't care if I had $1 trillion, because when I was sick, when my mom died, these people cared for me. These people took care of me.
Fabulous Acres, she tells me, is her ungated, gated community. For State of Opportunity, I'm April Van Buren.
Longtime residents Dottie Canty Armstrong and Marcus Brown are here with us now. Dottie, that name, Fabulous Acres, I understand you came up with it?
Well, what happened was that during the time we had community policing, our first community policing officer, his name was Bill Fabianchek. Everybody just adored this guy. He got to where he knew everybody on a first name basis, who your family was, who the kids was, and, you know, really helped the neighborhood. And we were trying to decide on a name. We all collectively got together and was like, well, let's call the neighborhood Fabianchek. He was like, no, no, that just doesn't. We were like, well, what about Fabulous, you know? And everybody just went with Fabulous. Thus, you know, we didn't get Fabianchek, but he's still in there, and thus became Fabulous Acres.
Tell me, Dottie, after all these years of calling it home, how do you describe Fabulous Acres? What makes it special?
Oh, wow, so many different things. The diversity. I not only have my family, but I have extended family, and we all look out for each other. I don't think I would trade it for anything, because I always tell people, if I lived in one of those ritzy neighborhoods, not to knock people who have lots of money, but if I did, I could see in my mind, you know, the burglar coming and moving all my stuff out the house and the neighbor sitting over there talking about, I thought you were moving out. But if my neighbors in my neighborhood, which is the million-dollar neighborhood to me, if they don't see me within a few hours or a day, they're coming knocking. Somebody better explain where I am and what's going on. And if nobody answers the door, they're coming in.
Marcus, what brought you to Fabulous Acres, and when did you come and call it home?
My wife and I moved to Fabulous Acres in 1995. I was in a doctoral program at MSU, and I was looking for a home to call a home that wouldn't be an apartment where my children could be raised. I know it had a great impact on me to be raised inside of a house as opposed to an apartment. But what I really appreciated about Fabulous Acres when I first got there, it was like almost like a Twilight Zone time warp, and it kind of reminded me of Detroit back in the 70s, or the neighborhood I was raised in on the east side of Detroit. I was raised right outside of Hamtramck in a place called Pole Town that really doesn't exist anymore. You might have a few scattered houses, and there's a lot of farmland now, but it was a crowded, diverse neighborhood with a lot of people in it that had different backgrounds but had a community and family feel to them, and that's what I kind of appreciated. I was like, this is a place where I can raise my children at. and I just started working as a public school teacher at the time. It felt right to me to live inside the community where I would be teaching and teaching the students who live next door to me.
And so there you have stayed. And we really are looking at your neighborhood because it has such a history of working together and coming up with ideas to make life better for everybody. And I know, Dottie, one of those projects is very special to you. Tell us about the Barb Dean Tot Lot. How did that come to be?
Well, you know, the tot lot, before it became a tot lot, it was a Diamond Reels parking lot. And our kids still played in it. So we'd have to make an effort of constantly going over there, picking up broken glass, trash, et cetera. A collective effort of people in our neighborhood all got together. And, you know, we went down to city council and kept on bugging them. Was like, you got this piece of land there. There's nothing going on with it. We got a bunch of kids. Can we get this land? And they gave it to us, and thus the park was created. It's called Barb Dean Tot Lot. Now, the funny thing about that is when the park was built, everybody now who was grown was a tot. So now their children and some of their children's children play in that tot lot now. So it really, really means something. And at that time, my godmother was the only Black female that I knew that was alive that had a park named after her.
And another part of the community that's very important is the Village Summit. And Marcus, I know this was your idea, buy the foreclosed house next to you and turn it into a micro community center. Why'd you think the neighborhood needed that?
Well, I had worked as a teacher for close to 20 years when we first opened up the Village Summit. And I had always been saying that, you know, someone needs to do something to help these kids out on the street. Someone needs to do something. Finally, something kicked in my head, and I said, I need to do something. So my wife and I discussed it, and we took our retirement money, even though we're not retired yet, and we bought the house next door and started making major renovations on it. And as we were doing that, the neighborhood started to come together and say, hey, he's building this for the children in the neighborhood. So landscaping started getting done by other neighbors. Other neighbors started to come in and volunteer to do painting or help with the floors or do multiple other things, and it became a community effort. And it's something that I learned and I grew from, because having been in the Marine Corps, you take that hero stance sometime. And this right here made me step back from the hero stance and say, no, people don't need someone to come in and fix a problem for them. People need to come together in order to fix the problem. Or you create that sense of entitlement or enablement where people are always expecting someone to fix the problem. So this was the community coming together to help build this community center and also to take ownership of it, in order to have something there, a resource there, that kids could take advantage of, whether it be with the serving of free lunches, learning how to play chess or guitar, or giving away free books, or access to the internet. Was just something that we want to have there where anyone in the community, especially children and families, could take advantage of the resource.
How do you fill it with resources? Do people donate money? Do people say, hey, I've got an extra computer? How do you keep it perking along and keep adding and building to it?
It's mostly been donations from people. We would appreciate more money coming in. We are a nonprofit, but most of the time people will say, hey, my children aren't using these books anymore. We've had a Jackson Insurance Company donate their older computers. You know, a lot of companies flip computers every 2 years, and they've donated computers to us in the past where we've just been able to use a slightly outdated system and just put a patch on it and an update on it and have it available to the kids. We have connections with the Book Bureau. We also have connections with Habitat for Humanity and a number of other local organizations that see us as being grassroots and action-oriented. You hear a lot of groups talk about doing different things, but we are actually about taking some type of action.
Dottie, what have you seen the Village Summit mean to Fabulous Acres, to the neighborhood?
When Village Summit came about, it was really a good thing that they kept the name Village, because we always lived by the term, it takes a village to raise a child. That's what we did. So the name Village Summit just kind of set right in. Actually, the house was owned by my godmother's best friend, Mrs. Ford. She would always keep books and stuff around. And
she was a librarian.
Let the kids come over and read and give them snacks. I know, because I was in that house too. But to see it now, with the help of, because, you know, we have a board, you know, Emil Island is our president. We have a great secretary, Lynn Martinez, our treasurer, Sarah Griffin, Marcus's wife, Chitra. She is the in and out. I call her the in and out because she does this thing, which I think is really cute. She'll come in and say, everybody good? You guys need something to eat? All right, I'm out. But she's always there if we need her. You know, she's one of the sweetest people.
I just have to jump in and say I'm noticing such an amazing ability for you to name everybody. And I dare say there's so many neighborhoods where people might know the name of the person on one side or the other, and that's it. Is that the secret sauce, if you will, that makes Fabulous Acres have really come together to accomplish an awful lot together?
That's one of the things. It's important to us. You know, when April, I think her name was, came through, and we did a walkthrough, and I gave her the history of the neighborhood. I felt proud to be able to go and say, okay, this person lives here, this person lives here, this is why this street is this way, or this street is this way, you know. And then to be able to go and then take her to the Village Summit and say, okay, well, this is the Village Summit, but the people who purchased the Village Summit live right next door. Mm-hmm. And everybody kind of gives me their kids. I don't know why, but they just, here, Dottie, Miss Dottie, yeah, you can go. You guys going to the landfill. It's all right, Miss Dottie, taking you. So Marcus has the, you know, the teaching thing where he comes in and probably one of the best chess players I know, even though I don't know how to play chess, you know, but he'll teach a kid how to play chess in a New York minute. But yeah, it's all about family. You know, we consider ourselves family. You know, we don't always agree, but we definitely are there for one another.
Marcus, what do you think other neighborhoods could learn from Fabulous Acres?
I think that the most important thing to learn, if you want to change your community, it can't be someone looking for a superhero to come in to fix all the problems or looking for a magic pill and everything will be okay here. A lot of problems inside inner city neighborhoods, lower economic neighborhoods, are problems that developed over a number of years. It's going to take time to solve those problems. I think that part of the formula of what we have that brings people together is that we allow contributions from everyone. Someone might not be a great tutor, but they can help us with other resources inside the center, which might be of a financial nature or doing repairs or helping us with gardening. We take contributions not only in the form of books or cash, but we also take people's time and allow them to volunteer and take ownership of the center. We don't turn away any volunteers. We find something for people to do. A small action can have a great reward or a positive return in the world. It's kind of like something that I learned from Rosa Parks, actually. You have someone who makes a small action, a small one decision not to get up, taking a stand by not getting up, and that has an impact on the world. Sometimes those small actions, volunteering your time with a child, teaching the kid how to fish or how to play dominoes or helping them with their math homework, that small one action might be an action that might change that child's world or actually change the world.
Well, the story of Fabulous Acres is a powerful one, and we really want to thank you both, Marcus Brown and Dottie Canty Armstrong. We want to thank you so much for sharing what it is that makes Fabulous Acres so very special. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.